Hi, everybody. This is Joanne, Science Goddess on Twitter, and you are here at Read Science, where Jeff, my co-host Jeff, and I like to talk with popular science authors about how they communicate complex and engaging topics with the general public. Today we have a treat because we have an engineer, one of the most prolific engineering writers, and I'm going to let Jeff introduce him.
Thanks, Joanne. This is Henry Petrosky, who describes himself as a lifelong student of the quotidian. He is an engineer and a writer, and he's written a lot about engineering, 18 books before this one, I'm told. He published his first popular book on the subject in 1985. That book was called To Engineer is Human, The Role of Failure in Successful Design, and that title right there establishes one of his enduring themes from the very beginning. I've been a fan of his ever since I read The Pencil, A History of Design and Circumstance, which was published in 1990. That's the book that taught me, among many other things, that one can indeed write about the pencil for over 400 pages and make it fascinating. I'm hoping to find out today how he does that. He's been at Duke University since 1980, where he's the Alexander S. Vasek Professor of Civil Engineering and professor in the Department of History. It is such a great pleasure to have you with us today, Henry. Thanks.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's good, as I'm taking a moment to share all over social media so people will join us here. Henry, so this is very common. Me being a biologist and Jeff being a physicist, we are considered scientists. But how about you define for the audience how an engineer is different than a scientist?
Well, there's an often quoted distinction that's attributed to Hun Carman, and it says that scientists seek to understand what is, engineers seek to create what never was. And I think it's a pretty good distinction. Engineers use science when it's to their advantage. They exploit it, you might even say. But sometimes there isn't science for them to exploit, mm-hmm. such as when the Wright brothers tried to develop a powered flight. They wrote to the Smithsonian looking for all the scientific background and got little in return that would help them design a proper propeller or a proper wing shape, and they went and did it on their own, and that's engineering at its basic.
I worked a lot of years with aerospace engineers as such, and developed a very keen appreciation of their skills and talents. And I think it's fair to say that we have, as scientists and you as an engineer, that we have different outlooks, but they're compatible, but they get along very well doing things.
You know, I can share a couple anecdotes. So being a biologist who has worked with things that engineers are also interested in, like electron microscopy, you could always see in sharp relief that engineers think differently about things than a biologist does. And one thing is us poor biologists are afraid of complicated machines on occasion. I think that's less and less true. But with the electron microscope, we had, there's a filament in the top where the electrons are forced off when you send a current through. And, if you send current through quickly, the filament could break, which is a hassle for the person, me, who would have to replace that. And so I'd say you want to carefully turn this knob up. And, of course, the biologist heard that as, it's going to explode if you turn it at all. And they're like turning the knob like, you know, like any minute. And then, of course, engineers don't know whatever. They just went, if it breaks, it gets fixed. You know, so they just crank it up. And I had to stop and say, I'm talking to you guys. You engineers, turn the knob slowly.
I don't know. But anyway. So,
yes, let's talk about the book. So actually, I don't know, Henry, if you had seen John Oliver ever, the comedian John Oliver, but he did a little episode about 20 minutes long about infrastructure. And, you know, of course, being a comedian, he said something along the lines that infrastructure is anything that can be blown up in a movie. Roads, dams, bridges, things like that. And that's exactly what your book, The Road Taken, talks about, specifically American infrastructure, though.
Yes, but and, I don't try to blow it up.
Yes, but your book doesn't blow anything up.
There is a quotation here from very early in the book that I had even written down where he writes, "To the average citizen, infrastructure is neither seen nor heard until it flashes or bangs and so makes the news." Mm.
So, and since I know that, you know, as you mentioned in the back of the book, a lot of these stories came from things you had written for American Scientists, different stories. So how long has the idea for this book been percolating in the back of your head?
Oh, it's hard to say. I write this regular column for American Scientists, and more than occasionally, I write about bridges, which are quintessential infrastructure to me. And infrastructure has been in the news, I would say, for the last 2 or 3 years, especially with the shenanigans going on in Washington. And I tried to follow that early on and began to realize I didn't know as much about how the infrastructure was funded by Washington and the states and other municipal entities, for example. And the way I learn about things is by writing about them, either in columns or in books. So I would say about 2 or 3 years ago is when it all came together, and I thought, let me write a book about infrastructure and try to explain first to myself and then to readers what it is all about, and especially where it interfaces with politics and financing. And that's where the whole book leads up to. I talk in the beginning about history, but I end with policy, really.
Right. I wasn't sure what to expect when I first started reading the book. I didn't know if we were going to get some quick lessons on how to make a stable bridge, or were we going to, you know, go the direction you went. And I'm glad you went the direction you went, because I learned some interesting things, and one was about how private companies and even foreign private companies are trying to get in on building and maintaining America's infrastructure. And I wonder if you could talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, they're not only trying to get in, they're being actively recruited. The mm-hmm. United States, especially the federal government and the state governments too, realize that this is a source of funding the infrastructure, which we've been having increasing difficulty doing, because if we're going to fund it internally, it basically means we're going to have to raise taxes. Mm-hmm. And politicians don't like to do that, so they like any idea that will take that off the table so they don't have to really discuss it. The gasoline tax, for example, every time we pump a gallon of gasoline, we pay tax on it. 18.4 cents to the federal government, and depending on what state you're in, it could be many times that for the state government. Now, of course, without that, our roads and bridges would probably be in worse shape than they are. But the federal government has been very reluctant to change the model. The gas tax, federal gas tax, has been stuck at 18.4 cents per gallon since 1993.
Yeah, very long time.
In the meantime, a lot of things have changed. There's been some inflation, not an awful lot in recent years, but certainly some. But also there is something counterintuitive that has happened. The government, at the same time that it has been promoting fuel-efficient vehicles, hybrid vehicles, giving tax credits, for example, that's bringing down the revenue from the gas tax, because, of course, this means using less gasoline.
Right.
So at the same time, they want more revenue to fix the roads. There are a lot of proposals going on now about what to do about that, and one of them is this seeking money from foreign and private investors, especially for big projects. like building a new road, building a toll road, building a bridge. And these have come to be called public-private partnerships. Usually, the government entity involved will grant a concession to some corporation, usually formed specifically to invest in the project. And, of course, they invest in it because they think they're going to get a return on their investment.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And therein lies the problem. They're not interested, first and foremost, in producing a public work that will serve the citizens of the United States. They're interested in recovering their investment and more. So there have been plenty of examples of toll roads, for example, that have gone bankrupt through these partnerships. And the government then just has to pick up the pieces and hopefully find another investor. And these are long-term deals, 50, 75, 100 years.
Right. That's interesting because I remember the chapter about the Indiana, one of the Indiana toll roads. And I was like, they're our neighbors. And I was like, I had no idea it was that much of a problem, but it makes sense. You know, it's funny because when you explain it, it's like hindsight is so clear. So I guess truckers were like, I'm not going to pay that much in toll because the private company had set a sort of a high toll. So instead, these trucks are taking side roads, which then, you know, cause wear and tear and increased maintenance for the side streets, which then the city has to pay for. Yeah, so it just ends up being a big mess. Yeah.
Yeah, they're
very enlightening.
You gave us several interesting stories about these public-private partnerships, and I couldn't tell, but it led me to make a note to ask you, do you think they're always prone to disaster, or is it possible that good things can happen about them? Do you have any optimism about these private-public partnerships?
Well, I think if the partnership is done correctly from the beginning, and what I mean by correctly is fairly, really, that there's a recognition that it really is a partnership and it shouldn't be totally unbalanced toward the investor, which it very often is. And those who are investing, they usually have the experience. They've done this before many times. So they know how to write a contract to their advantage.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a municipality or a toll road authority, this is probably the first time they've been doing it. So they don't know exactly what to look for in a contract. They're green. They're inexperienced. So I'm pessimistic in that regard. I think probably what we need is some kind of public interest representative, somebody like a Ralph Nader, who is going to watch out for the public interest in writing these contracts and perhaps advise them on, you know, what it is they're giving away and what kind of liability they're assuming that they don't realize. And I believe the best way to learn this stuff, if you don't have a Ralph Nader at your side, is to look at case studies. And that chapter on public-private partnerships in the book is a series of case studies. Mostly those that have gone wrong, because it's those that have gone wrong that we learn the most from. We learn what not to do. We learn the pitfalls. I'm a firm believer that we don't learn very much from successes because each project is different. It's got local qualities that another one didn't have. So you don't learn very much. What you learn is you can get trapped into a partnership that's modeled after something that's irrelevant.
So we have to learn from the failures, your enduring theme. And how do you abstract from failures being just a string of singular events then? When do you start to get a pattern, or do you just have to keep a large dictionary of things not to do in the next contract? Or is the abstraction when you have an oversight office or you have someone who comes along and can add that layer of oversight?
Well, I think if you look at enough individual cases, I think you begin to see patterns. You know, there's a famous book in literature called 7 Degrees of Ambiguity, I believe it is, or you can start classifying things and you can start understanding them after not too much effort. The fact of the matter is that you should have escape clauses, for example. Mm. I mean, that's something you can gather from diverse set of examples that might seem to be totally unrelated, but if you have an escape clause, then you're protected in some way, and you don't have to really be a genius to come to that conclusion after a fair number of case studies.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so much has to do with human nature too, and I think the case studies reveal human nature, reveal the mistakes that municipalities have made. Very often the failed public-private partnerships were arrived at rather hastily, because they're very tempting, because the private partner pays a lot of money up front for the right to gain the return on the investment.
And to solve a pressing problem for the
And we talk about billions of dollars. So if you're a state, for example, and you're trying to figure out how to balance your budget, well, $1 billion, well, that could go a long way in helping you. But that's a one-time thing.
Yeah.
Right. And next year you're going to be faced with another unbalanced budget, and you're not going to be able to, grant a concession for that same tollway. So I think lessons like that become clear. Chicago entered into some unwise arrangements having to do with its parking spaces.
Parking. Yeah.
And all you have to do is run the numbers in certain cases, like Chicago. But apparently they didn't run the numbers carefully enough. Some city council people are not numbers people. They rely upon staff, and they rely upon, argument being brought to them.
But we know, even if they have the numbers, they have the models, there are variables and limits to things. And if they really want something to happen, they're going to run those numbers optimistically to justify their decisions. And that's not the way to success, is it?
Well, that's right. Yeah, over-optimism is another lesson you can draw from these case studies. Yeah.
I think, let's talk a little bit about engineer and failing and things like that. So, and in hindsight for many things, when you were talking about the Tappan Zee Bridge, it's like such a famous example of a bridge in need of repair, and then how are we going to pay for it? And then the decisions to make, such as, do we destroy the old one? Do we repair this and do we destroy this and build a new one? Do we repair this one? What are the ecological issues? And I guess, to be an engineer means to try to see every possible eventuality, but that's not always possible. So, I'm curious. Would you say that most engineering firms are, attempting to do what's best for the community, what's best for the budget, there's a balance of so many things that engineers have to think of. A scientist, we do our science thing, but engineers, it's not just, let's just build something. It's like, let's build it with the best, the most economical way possible that can be scaled up, that could be whatever. So I think thinking like an engineer is very different than thinking like most people in the world. So I'm curious, so how do engineers approach building a bridge? And what factors are you weighing overall?
Well, engineers seldom work alone, because the projects, especially if we're talking about bridges, we're almost always talking about pieces of property that are owned by somebody else, first of all, and that cost millions, tens of millions, or even billions of dollars. And no engineer or engineering firm typically can build a bridge on its own. Generally, unless you're building a bridge on private property, you just can't put a bridge across a river You have to get political permission, basically, and then you need to finance it. And there are all sorts of federal hurdles, and there could be more local hurdles, too, about permissions to do this or do that, relating to the environment, or relating to other issues. So engineers who work in those areas become familiar very soon with the constraints they have to work around, and they become very familiar soon with the people they have to work with, meaning people in government, meaning protesters, meaning opponents to the project. Mm-hmm. Right? In the case of the Tappan Zee Bridge, which you mentioned, there were a lot of people that didn't want the project to go ahead unless it included light rail system across the mm-hmm. across the river. That eventually didn't happen, largely for budgetary reasons, but the bridge that will eventually be built, and it's under construction, it's a long way along right now, will have accommodations for light rail system, but that light rail system will cost probably more than the bridge itself. The Tappan Zee Bridge also is, I don't think it's paid for yet. I don't think they know how to pay for it. They're going ahead and building it, but the financing is not fully in place as far as I know.
Those of us who aren't engineers may not realize, but you brought this out, that any specific bridge someplace that is being built has constraints that we can think of, like money and materials and things like that, but it also is designed with a lifetime involved. It's designed to last for 50 years, perhaps, given that trucks are going to go over it this frequently, and they're going to weigh this much, and there will be this much traffic and things. And when those get violated, the bridge falls down sooner as well. And I don't know. That's one reason for people to read the book, is to find out that, yes, there's all these things involved in that, and that's part of why bridges succeed and part of why they fail, perhaps. But engineering is an interesting business.
Yes, it is. And you bring up a very good example. You can't just sit down and design a bridge in the abstract. It's mm-hmm. something that's out there in the real world, which means that you have to know how many cars and trucks are going to drive over it, because they affect its lifetime. And if you've been instructed to design a bridge to last for 50 years, let's say, then you have to know with pretty good reliability what the volume of traffic will be and what the nature of the traffic will be. And that's usually fairly easy to do in the context of when you set out to begin your design. But unfortunately, it can be a moving target, and politicians can change mm-hmm. what trucks are allowed to drive on our roads and therefore go over our bridges. They can increase the weight allowance. That's one of the big problems with infrastructure that's not often appreciated, is that there isn't a full cooperation between the technical aspects, which mm-hmm. is usually reached through the engineers, and the political aspects, which have to do with regulation, which have to do with allowance also, and what trucks are allowed on the road. And then we get into lobbying, because the trucking company, trucking industry, wants longer trucks, heavier mm-hmm. trucks. They want trucks to go faster. Right now, one of the issues that's going on is they want drivers to be younger. They want younger drivers allowed behind the biggest trucks. So that, by definition, that means they're inexperienced drivers. Mm-hmm. So these tugs of war are constantly going on. Why does the industry want the age for drivers of these 18-wheelers to go down to 18 years?
So they pay them less.
Pay them less, exactly.
To what? Pay them less?
So they can pay them less is the first thing that comes to my mind. But
there's another big issue, and that is the trucking industry has found that they have a large turnover in mm-hmm. drivers. And if you think, when you're behind these big trucks, you often see a sign on the back interested in driving, or we need drivers, call 1-800-SOSA.
Yeah.
And that's because of their large turnover. And they estimate that it costs them about, say, $5,000 to hire a new trucker and train him in that, mm-hmm. Industry. So if you've got a sizable fleet, you can be talking about millions of dollars a year just to maintain mm-hmm. your mm-hmm. driver inventory. And this is nothing. This is where history, I think, is so helpful to understand motives of why things are done. They're often done for things that are not self-evident. Mm-hmm. Henry Ford, when he was developing his Model T, the famous story is that he made it so cheap that his workers could afford it. But there's another aspect to Henry Ford and the Model T, and that is he also had a problem with the turnover of his workers. And it was costing him a lot of money, and he recognized that. So he decided to pay them more money, not to be generous, but also but to be able to retain workers. Mm-hmm. Because if he paid them a high wage, they wouldn't be leaving. They would stay put.
So before we leave Bridges, at least for a little bit, but I'm sure we'll be back, you talked about two cases that are rather contrast. You talked about the Millau Viaduct in the south of France, isn't it? It's like, and how easy and graceful it was, and how it was finished under budget, and its beautiful design, and within time frame. And then there's the drama and everything that went wrong with the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge project, which was pretty amazing drama. It's like, what is the difference? We know that some things can be done right, and then what makes them go wrong?
Oh, I think to a large extent it's the people involved in, this mm-hmm. word leadership that we hear so much about. Mm-hmm. The French bridge, the viaduct, very strong personalities involved. The architect, it was an engineer and an architect partnership, and the architect was Norman Foster, world-class architect, strong personality, probably everybody that, dealt with him on that bridge deferred to him. The engineer was Michael Villejoux, who isn't so widely known here, but in France, he is, a top-notch engineer, and he should actually get as much credit, at least, as Norman Foster, but that's another story. I think here in the U.S., we don't know the names of the people who are working on our infrastructure, who are building our bridges. The people in the San Francisco Oakland Bay Bridge, you'd be pretty hard-pressed to name mm-hmm. who they were, and if somebody did name them to you, you wouldn't recognize the significance of those names. It was basically a state highway project.
Mm-hmm.
That's who owns most infrastructure, road infrastructure in this country, are the states and the Department of Transportation within those states. And so those people, as good as they might be, they're virtually anonymous. They don't have a face. Mm-hmm. And they don't necessarily have a personality that is strong either. They may be strong within a certain group of people, but when it comes to the bigger picture of, I'm going to make sure this bridge gets built right because I'm proud to be not only a Californian mm-hmm. but an American, and we want to make sure that it's done without fault. I don't think there is that attitude present.
Is that where you find the difference between an attitude on the one hand of a force, an idea for design that a bridge should be beautiful in order to achieve its function versus it's just a damn bridge, build it?
In some cases, it'd be hard to. I wouldn't generalize to that extent because historically there's an excellent example of Oregon, the Coast Highway mm-hmm. in Oregon 101. Is a museum of beautiful bridges, and that was due to an engineer who had a strong personality. In fact, his name was Condé McCullough, And he had such a strong commitment to doing things right with an aesthetic sense that, mm-hmm. that he, after he had become state bridge engineer, he went and studied to get a law degree so he could understand the politics of shepherding these bridges through the right. state highway system.
So it sounds it's someone who cares. It's someone who yeah. takes pride in it. And later in our time, I want to talk about quality. But since you mentioned the name McCulloch, one thing that continues to surprise me, and surprised me in your book, when I was reading McCulloch's History of the Brooklyn Bridge,
You're talking about David McCulloch.
David McCulloch now. Almost shocked to discover that the Brooklyn Bridge was a private enterprise. I had never thought about that. That was the first time I'd come to find out how often this happens. And then you tell me, you write about the early days of roads and cars and the fact that municipalities didn't put up signs, didn't make road markings, there were no traffic signals in the early days. What a shock that is. And that signs were put up by motor clubs for the benefit of their members, and that markings came along much later, and traffic signals were a good idea that someone had. And now, I mean, any of us would say, like, shouldn't our municipal government be doing that? Like, there's a big transition there, but I'm still surprised at how much private initiative is involved, which is kind of reassuring and kind of strange. But
well, it's got to do with the historical development of roads and bridges and infrastructure generally. Back in the 19th century in this country, with the development of the railroads were all private enterprise, of course. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they cooperated with the government, other times they fought with the government. But as far as putting up a road, that was the federal government had hardly anything to do with that. The only authorization the Constitution gives the federal government with regard to roads is to build post roads on which over which the mail was delivered. And then it's still debated how much authority was given to the federal government, and people think pretty much it was to identify what roads were appropriate to use for the mail. Mm. Even today, the federal government does not own any of the roads. The interstates are individually owned by the states. Now, of course, the federal government likes to maintain a certain control, and they do that by giving grants to the states to build and maintain those roads if the states will agree to follow federal guidelines, federal standards. That's a good interaction yes. between the states and the federal government, because we wouldn't want to drive over a state line, let's say, and suddenly have the nature of the roadway change. We wouldn't suddenly want to have the yellow line that's on our left suddenly be on our right. That would be disorienting and dangerous. So there are some good things that come out of the federal government. Yeah.
But I had made a note.
Technology of signs and small pieces of infrastructure coming after the existence of roads and bridges and so forth. In an earlier book, I wrote about little things, the book called The Evolution of Useful Things.
Yes.
And I tell the story there in some detail about the invention of the tin can and the evolution of it from a wrought iron heavy-bodied device. Nobody thought about a can opener before a can existed.
Mm-hmm.
It was the existence of the can, which was difficult to open because it was made of heavy wrought iron, that led to inventors trying to invent a can opener. We wouldn't, of course, have inventors trying to invent a mouse trap if there weren't a mouse already. Yeah. The motivations for invention and development of things comes from the existence of problems.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That was one thing in the girls' engineering camp. I'm in charge of bioengineering, obviously, but that we would say is that engineers are trying to solve problems, you know, and scientists are looking for the science and explanations for things. I'd like to sort of jump back to this architect idea, and specifically one who just passed away, Zaha Hadid, And she is known for her really swooping designs and beautiful designs. And I saw the bridge she designed in Abu Dhabi, which has, you know, instead of your typical, you know, trusses and I'm going to get all the words wrong, but she had this sort of, it looked like a wave pattern. It was amazing. And so I wonder, for as innovative as she was, one of the critiques of her was that her designs were very difficult to build. Do engineers go, I am so excited to try this design, or do they just sometimes go, forget it, it's not going to work?
Well, it would depend on how experienced the engineer is. But probably the most famous example is the Sydney Opera House. That was a world-class design competition, and the winner was based on a sketch of this assemblage of shells, and it proved to be very, very difficult to build, and engineers finally were able to design a structure to hold it up, but only by making certain modifications, and there was effectively a fallout between the architects and not the engineers so much directly as with the city of Sydney. So the architect never visited Sydney to see his completed opera house. Architects tend to think in terms of form. Mm-hmm. Engineers tend to think in terms of function. And therein really lies the problem. Form is fine, but if it's something like a bridge or a building, it also has to work properly. It has to obviously carry traffic if it's a bridge. It has to not sway too much in the wind if it's a tall building. So the best buildings are actually those that have a shared creative spirit from architects and engineers. And there are some firms that are called architect-engineer firms, mm-hmm. where there's a partnership between architecture and engineering, and the tallest buildings in the world are developed collaboratively, mm-hmm. Because right. you just can't, you know, sketch on a piece of paper and say, well, let's just design this. I mean, Frank Lloyd Wright is famous for having designed a mile-high skyscraper back in 1950 mm-hmm. that remains unbuilt. It's probably the case that engineers could design it, but there are even further problems, and that is, do you really need it, or do you want it?
Yeah, you know, exactly.
There's often a tension between engineers and architects.
But on this same subject, so here's quotation I wanted to be sure to say from the book, page 142, where you say, function without form does not uplift the soul, which I think is a very useful observation. And I ask, why does everyone seem to think uplifting the soul is unimportant, even though everyone seems to enjoy it?
Oh, I don't know if everybody thinks it's unimportant. I think I certainly think it's important. But you're in Maryland, I believe, and I understand Maryland is specifically a state that specifically thinks in terms of aesthetics with its highway bridges. Especially its newer ones.
It sometimes does do that, and there's, you know, it's one of the places where you'll find a small amount of money mandated for public art and various other things, and I think there is some sense that design is worth doing and not just extra credit.
Right.
And that should then be, you know, maybe a new maxim for you. We need a catchphrase, but, you know, design and function are both essential components. I'm good with that.
Well, it sounds good for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, you know, I was. I have to say, your book, I've said it before, is so eye-opening and so informative. Like, I just, even simple things like, why were, you know, stop signs weren't always red, except in California, like. California always had red stop sign, and it wasn't octagon. And then the reason why they weren't red was because red would fade. It was really a practical thing. And then as they were able to make signs that were the red paint would say, then, you know, then I forget who said, yes, all stop signs should now be red with white letters. But this kind of information is just like, the book is full of this stuff. It's so interesting. Or I knew something a little bit about the fonts and font sizes for highway signs, you know, that were taken into consideration. But it's pretty amazing how things became standardized. Frankly, really amazing that over across a big country we were able to do that.
Yes, but it also, as I tell in the book, took quite a while, you know, decades to come to agreement. And often the agreement was reached after, you know, let's say a little enticement by saying, well, if you don't use this typeface, or, well, no, that's a bad example because they never did say that, but if, you know, the stop sign must look this way or that way, mm-hmm. we won't give you the money. That helps. That helps enforce it. But standardization is, let's put it this way, you know, in bridges over the interstate, if you have too much standardization, it becomes boring.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a highway, a parkway up in Connecticut named the Merritt Parkway, and literally every bridge is different. Yeah. And it's such a pleasure to drive along that parkway because you see, not only do you see a variety of bridges that are graceful, you like some more than others because if they're different, you know, you're going to have a different impression of them. But at the same time, you don't get bored, and you have a sense of that you're getting somewhere. You're not just going over under the same overpass again and again and again and mm-hmm. again. But things like stop signs, they're, you know, and traffic lights, and guardrails, the lines on the road, these are safety issues. And you don't want people to have to think and stop and admire them. Oh, isn't it nice that this stop sign is chartreuse rather than red? You don't want that. you want people to unconsciously, subconsciously react as fast as possible to that kind of infrastructure. So
right,
there,
if you are distracting your neurons with other details, you can do what you need to do.
Too many flourishes on something like that. It's something that should be hung in an art gallery, not in you know, put up on a corner in the street.
In light of current politics and the feeling that maybe we're somehow unique, I was entertained by the anecdote, the story that you tell, that stop signs elicited such strong feelings of opposition to them that in 1922 they were ruled illegal by courts in Illinois because they were a violation of the rights of individuals to cross streets.
Right.
We're talking.
And
it's never smooth, is it?
Of the lights on traffic signals. We're so used to the red being on top and the green on the bottom. That's very good, by the way, because about 10% of male drivers are colorblind. And the only way they know whether the light is red or green is by seeing its position. But up in Syracuse, New York, for example, there's a large Irish-American community. To them, green means Ireland. Yeah. And nobody should be above Ireland to them. Now, I haven't seen this personally, but I've seen it verified that if you go through this little neighborhood in Syracuse, the green light is on top.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Syracuse, I'm going to try to find that to experience it, but that's a quirk. Obviously.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah. But speaking of the Merritt Parkway and things, you gave us early on a nice appreciation. I think this is in line with your philosophy of enjoying the quotidian. Things you enumerated things that make highway driving a pleasant experience: curves, gentle grades, shoulders, attractive and informative signs, lane markings, things that deserve attention of their own. Do you have any favorite really good ideas, the stuff that, you know, well, one, we know about the little reflective things, little bumps that are embedded in the road that reflect, that those have always seemed to fascinate you, but, you know, what are your favorite road road markings. The guardrail came in for some accolades too, and that was well deserved. You seem to enjoy driving for reasons that may be different from, well, other folks.
Well, I don't actually do that much driving. I have an old Volvo from the mid 90s, and its odometer just turned 100,000. So I drive about 5,000 miles a year by that.
Oh, yeah.
But I do drive a lot between North Carolina and Maine, where I spend my summers and do my riding. And that's mostly on interstates, and that's where I guess I amuse myself by watching the road. And it's kind of a tricky tension because you don't want to get distracted too much.
Yeah.
But I try to find ways to avoid the truck traffic, and that's how I find things like the Merritt Parkway as an alternate route. Up in the Baltimore area, I take the Baltimore-Washington Express, a parkway, to get off the interstate, which is a respite from trucks. And it's amazing how much you can discover that way. And these are very relaxing experiences because your vision is not blocked by the trucks, and also you feel safer without having these big 18-wheelers at your side.
Well, I'm sure it beats the flat Illinois roads.
Well, most of the
Midwest, it's just the most dull drive you can imagine.
Oh, I know. When I first went out to, I went to graduate school at Illinois. I drove out from New York City, where I grew up, and my everlasting memory is going through Indiana because my friend dropped me off. But he stopped by Purdue first, where he was going to go to school, and driving through the cornfields was amazing. The time of year, at a certain time of year, you can't really see the flatness because you're in a canyon of corn.
Yep.
But
sea of corn.
Comes off the prairie. It's quite a different experience. Yeah,
it's a different place. I went to school in Iowa, and I liked Iowa very much.
Uh-huh.
Since you did that, the first thing I noted, a note that I wrote, after we got through the preface, the very first thing you said, or the words you wrote, was, I grew up in, you started with you. You didn't start with a bridge or something. And so I wondered if we could hear a little bit about, I don't know, your relationship with, the importance of, where you think the place of personal narrative is when, you know, you're talking about engineering, which some people think of as a rather dispassionate thing. And I agree with you that it's personal narrative has an important place there. Does that just come naturally to you?
You mean writing about that kind of stuff?
Your experiences, your storytelling. Storytelling, when you're writing about engineering, you like to tell stories, don't you?
Yes, I think that's very fair. I do, and I like to write narrative,
you learn lessons from those stories, and we learn lessons from those stories, and they're more, I don't know, they're more direct, they're more interesting. That's why, I've been enjoying your writing since the pencil, I suppose.
Yeah, well, they're more human. You know, my first book was called To Engineers Human, and I tell a lot of little stories in there about not so much my growing up, but actually my children growing up, because that was what was happening at the time I wrote that book. But they taught me a lot, these little events with my children, and I guess I didn't know at the time, since it was my first book, whether they would work with the reader, but they did. They resonated with readers. I do believe engineering is a human endeavor. It really is, and I think it's timeless, and I've written about this in more technical terms in other books and papers, that the way engineers think today is probably not very much different from the way engineers thought 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be backed up, that kind of statement. The book Vitruvius's 10 Books on Architecture from the first century B.C. Is really about... today we would call it architecture and engineering, and what he talks about in there is totally familiar to somebody like me and anybody who would, you know, choose to read that book with an open mind, I believe. So this is the constant, let's say, of engineering. We have some, you know, artificial differences due to the time in which we grew up and the experiences we have. But I grew up in Brooklyn in Park Slope and used to walk up the slope, up the hill, to Prospect Park to play. Spent a lot of time in Prospect Park. To this day, that's my paradigmatic park, Prospect Park. And you know, you form these not just images but experiences by which we tend to measure future experiences. And it's just, I think it's the way things work for us. Us as human beings. In writing that book, it was a very honest experience in writing it, I tried to convey that, and how important failure was. That book's all about failure, really. Yep. So,
but yeah, which is where do you have it? You know, when you talk about long periods of non-failure known as success, that we tend to think of success as the normal thing somehow, and failure as something not normal or out of the normal, and normalizing, I don't know, our relationship with failure as part of the process has been an important theme for you. That's really important in people get straight. But finishing up the narrative idea, there are insights to be had in telling those personal stories too. I was fascinated because I'd never thought about it. It's like, here you are, you're growing up, and as you point out, if one were driving, you're not very far from the Brooklyn Bridge, which might have done very interesting things if you had seen it early on, but you didn't see it till later because you were a walker.
Right.
And it was not within your sphere, your scope as a walker. It might have well as been in another country, another planet, because what you knew was what you saw by walking. Did that give you, you know, your introduction to the quotidian? While you're walking, next to the curbs on the roads and seeing the grates that go down from the storm sewers and things like that. I don't know, why are these quotidian aspects the things that caught your eye and became your life's work?
Oh, I don't know. I guess that kind of thing is the mystery of life in a way. I don't know. you know, I certainly could have walked to the Brooklyn Bridge. It was within a couple of miles. It was just not, I was young. I was, you know, and I listened to my mother, don't go too far. You can go up to Prospect Park. In those days, going to the park was not considered risky at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, walking maybe to the Brooklyn Bridge would have been considered riskier. So it so much depends on the time and place and environment, context in which I think we grow up, what happens. And, of course, there's something in each of us, in each of our heads, that makes us different. And somebody else in exactly my situation might have ended up being totally different because, I don't think the psychologists have figured this out yet.
No, it's maybe just as well. A little bit of mystery doesn't hurt.
Right. Yes.
I'm wondering, you know, because I have a lot of young people who follow me and they always ask for advice, what should I do to be a this? What should I do to be a that? What would your advice to maybe someone in high school who wants to be an engineer? What would you recommend?
Oh, I would recommend that they do a little reading about what engineering is. There's a phenomenon that's developed, and it seems that a lot of high school assignments these days are to contact an engineer and interview the engineer, and the questions are almost the same always. What is a typical work day for you? What do you do during that day, you know, and so forth. They never ask, are you a typical engineer?
Mm-hmm.
that really should be the first question. Usually, depending on my mood, I answer those students in a either straightforwardly or not. And sometimes they get nasty responses from parents. because, yes. You know, I haven't given them what they expect I should answer. Well, I don't know. I think the instructors maybe should be a little more proactive in saying, hey, heads up, my students are going to call you on this. That would be nice.
I was thinking that those students who are trying to figure out how to get past their first 100 words on an unwritable essay could do a lot worse than to read the pencil and learn how you can find the interesting things in the smallest places, and that there's a lot more going on that they can write about than they realize.
Yeah. I do think young people today are reading, but almost exclusively online. And I think they're missing something I'm not saying they should read my books necessarily, but I think they should read some books. They should read classic literature, for example, and just to have
different sizes.
Language with the rest of the universe.
Right. And long things and short things and longer things, because they're not the same type of thing at all.
That's true.
Before I ask if you have anything else to add, there was one interesting thing. I was at a bookstore. There was an author there, and a woman came up to me. I don't know how I sort of got pulled into the conversation, but this woman came up to me. She is an engineer. And her little son said, her son was 5, and said, oh, it's so great how scientists did all that work to make the space shuttle or the International Space Station or something like that. And she goes, scientists and engineers. And so based on that, she wrote a book, a little kid's book for 4 or 5-year-old kids about different kinds of engineers, because it seems like most people just automatically say scientists, and they forget it's the engineers who are actually, you know, making these things happen.
Yeah, so, I'm glad to hear that story.
Yes, it's a cute book. I'll remember to send you a link. I'll put that underneath the video, too, for people's references. It's really adorable. But
before we wrap up, Joanne.
Yeah, go ahead.
I know we're about to, but I have two short answer questions that I want to settle. One is, sometime later in the book, you wrote, the pothole is seen uniformly to be a blight on the roadway in a way that the speed hump, curiously, is not. And I felt you were speaking to me because I detest speed humps, and I wondered whether you hate speed humps as much as I do.
Yes.
Okay. Then the other one, that's enough for me.
Not knowing how much you hate them.
Well, I hate them. I think they are antisocial devices that are cold and cruel and unwelcoming. And when I was looking for a house to buy that was separate from an apartment, I early on decided that, you know, like, of the three things that I would not accept, I would not expect a speed hump in a development, because I didn't want to come home to that. Uh-huh. Did not feel like the beginning of relaxation to me. And then the other one is, I think we need a status update, since the book came out, on the incipient sinkhole in your driveway. Is it any worse?
Well, it's slowly sinking more. We have a big construction project going on nearby, and until that's finished, we're not going to do anything about that. But as soon as that construction project is finished, something that's out of our control, we will get that done.
Okay. All right. I'm done, Jim.
Very good. So, Henry, thank you for being with us. Do you have anything else we should know, or the viewers should know, before we sign off?
Oh, gee, I don't know. I think this has been very enjoyable. I think we've covered a lot of ground.
Yes.
And I'm so pleased to hear the enthusiasm about the book from you. I'm always interested in what people pick out from the book, and it's been a pleasure to hear that what you guys have picked out have been some of my favorite parts.
Oh, good.
Well, I guess there's a certain resonance there.
That's great. That's wonderful. Okay, so for everybody watching, as a reminder, the book we've been talking about is The Road Taken. And believe me, if you type The Road Taken in Google, it keeps trying to send you to The Road Not Taken, which you guys should all know anyway because Robert Foss. But this book is really good, very informative. Every chapter I'd be like, oh, yeah, that's so neat. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. So pick up a copy. And if you don't like this particular topic, I'm sure any of Henry Petrosky's other books would be of interest to someone out there. So very good book, very enjoyable conversation, Henry. And Jeff, as always, a pleasure to host with you. And we will see you guys again next time on Read Science.